course. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to SoftRep Radio, SoftRep Radio on time, on target. I'm your host this afternoon, Steve Balistrieri. We have a great show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking with the people from the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. They have recently co-produced a documentary with the History Channel titled Revealed, The Hunt for Bin Laden. And it's based on the museum special exhibition of the exact same name. And they were granted unprecedented access to military and intelligence officials who worked on the bin Laden, you know, search for over a decade. And some of whom, you know, their identities still aren't revealed to the public, as well as several of the SEAL team members who took part in this on the ground. This documentary is going to premiere on May 2nd and will be available for streaming afterwards. I've seen the trailer. If you haven't watched the trailer yet, I guarantee you it's going to get your interest. It looks extremely well done. And joining us to talk about this is Clifford Channon. He's the Executive Vice President and Deputy Director for Museum Programs of the 9/11 Museum. And we want to welcome him to the podcast. Clifford, thanks for taking the time with us this afternoon. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Steve. I'm really happy to be here. And thank you for your interest in this and your service.
Oh, we're very interested in this. I think this is something, you know, a lot of Americans don't understand what goes on in the day-to-day when, you know, we have people in harm's way in Afghanistan and Iraq. But when you talk about Osama bin Laden and 9/11, I don't think anyone doesn't understand what that's all about.
No, it's true. And, you know, going back to really the earliest days of the museum and when we were planning for it, because I've worked on this when it was just a project at the beginning of the museum project. I came on as a consultant in May 2005. And, you know, we had to really pay a lot of attention as we were planning out the narrative of the museum, the whole history of 9/11. You know, how do you portray the terrorists? How do you include them in a story like this? Our place is certainly focused on education, but it's also focused on commemorating the attacks and honoring the victims and those marking the service of those who came to help. And so combining those things in the museum itself posed certain challenges. And we had, you know, a long haul to go to get to the point of feeling like after testing it and really running through a lot of conversations, you know, how to get the perpetrators into the story. And bin Laden, of course, was the leader of Al-Qaeda. Was the one who wanted to target the United States in the homeland. The earlier attacks before 9/11 at the U.S. embassies in 1998, at the USS Cole in Yemen in 2000. I mean, these were ways of leading up to the 9/11 attack, testing our resolve, testing our response. And so, you know, it was, you know, not really possible as we thought about this to tell the story without him, but clearly, this is the lead perpetrator. And of course, when Operation Neptune Spear occurred in May 2011, well, that was the end of this very, very significant chapter of the broader 9/11 story. It's not the end of Al-Qaeda, but the end of bin Laden's life was obviously a chapter that we wanted to pursue in more detail, first with the exhibition and then with the film, which runs Sunday, May 2nd at 8 o'clock on the History Channel, 8 o'clock Eastern and Pacific times. And then inside in the other time zones, it's an hour off from that.
Now, how did you come to be involved with the 9/11 Memorial and Museum?
So, you know, I've worked prior to this in a lot of different areas. I worked in as a journalist. I worked in the mayor's office in New York. And in the 1990s, I was a program officer at the Rockefeller Foundation, which is a globally oriented foundation. And really in the early 90s, it was the president of the foundation then who was interested in exploring this issue that wasn't getting a lot of attention at the time. And that was I mean, essentially the Islamic revival as it was beginning to stir in different countries around the world. And I became the person whose job it was to go look at these places, try to, you know, talk to people who understood what was going on there. And so, you know, over a decade, I had really built up this experience, these networks and so on. And so as the, you know, fast forward to the planning efforts after 9/11, it was an area in which I had, some experience that was useful at that time, thinking about, you know, how to think of the problem, really. And so I had also done some work on how societies memorialize mass violence. And so those two things, which pre-9/11 were very separate, after 9/11 sort of came together in this very strange way.
Now, was that part of Legacy Project?
So Legacy Project was, after I left Rockefeller, sort of a way to dig more deeply into this notion of historical memory and, you know, how it plays in contemporary societies. So, you know, it's the 9/11 Memorial Museum then became, you know, for me, almost a test case of seeing how that operates. And so, you know, I was very interested in what was going on from the beginning. And when I had the opportunity to get involved, it was really, you know, something that, you know, everybody, familiar quote from William Faulkner, who wrote, you know, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. And, you know, we can see that even now in America, in many of our contemporary debates, you don't simply turn the page in the history book and leave it in the past. And I was always very interested in how these issues of conflict or violence or whatever it was manifested themselves in current day society. And so, you know, the 9/11 example was in real time, is trying to see how America assimilated, if it could, this terrible injury and what the responses would be. And those responses could come in, you know, many, many different ways, military, cultural, religious, you know, in terms of civil liberties. I mean, on and on, the debates we've had in America over the last 20 years are, you know, in some ways all coming out of that terrible, terrible day on September 11th, 2001.
You know, it's funny because, you know, when you talk to Americans, especially some that might be a little bit older than others, you can ask people three questions. And usually if they were alive during that time, they can always answer that. And as for older Americans, and I was just barely old enough to remember this, where were you the day Kennedy was shot?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Where were you when the man first landed on the moon? And I remember, you know, glued to my parents' television set at that time.
Me too.
And then where were you on 9/11? Were you living in New York City at the time?
Yeah, I'm a native New Yorker, born and bred, still live in Brooklyn, where I was born. And so, I mean, my story is not particularly dramatic. I was at home that morning and trying to follow it, you know, initially just getting ready to drive into the city. I was bringing someone for a medical appointment and heard about the first plane. They were saying on the radio, it's a small plane or whatever. And I was in the car actually just about to drive across the Brooklyn Bridge when the second plane hit the second tower, the South Tower. And, you know, I was looking ahead, but people lining the sidewalk, I heard them just scream as that flight 175 hit the South Tower. And of course the police were pulling in front of the bridge and not allowing anybody to go. So I just basically turned around, went home, and I spent the day like really anybody else just watching TV. But even though the event was right across the river from my house.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it was shocking at the time because, you know, we're used to seeing bad things happen to other people, but not so much, you know, inside the United States. We've had our share, but nothing like this ever before. Hopefully never again.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it was an absolute shock. And I remember I had recently gotten out of the military and I was working for a civilian company. And my boss said, hey, he called me in his office, come look at this. And, you know, the first news reports were coming aboard about the first plane hitting the World Trade Center. And I told him it has to be terrorism. On a bright, beautiful, sunny day in New York City, some pilot's just not going to lose his way and hit the middle of the World Trade Center. And he was kind of poo-pooing it at the time. He was like, no, there's no way. And then we were sitting there, and of course, all work stopped, and everyone was crowding around his desk. And then the second plane hit. And then I don't think there was any doubt in anyone's mind at that point.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely it. And of course, you were right to see it the way you did, though not everybody was aware of the threat until 17 minutes later. I mean, you know, the precise moment when that picture changed. And so, you know, I'm sure you felt it, you know, with your background, but, you know, everybody wanted to figure out a way to do something to help. It was just this, you know, moment where the country was under attack. And you think about it, I mean, Al-Qaeda was, you know, it was a small terrorist group, basically. And the estimates were for, you know, a couple $100,000, they put this plan together and did something to us that none of our enemies at wartime had managed to do over the history of this country, going back, of course, to the War of 1812. So, you know, just an amazing, amazing set of events led to their ability to just accomplish this. And they saw it as a real accomplishment and a feat. I don't think they realized it would, you know, bring us into Afghanistan at the time, but, you know, this is just a remarkable story, a remarkable day in the 20 years since.
So explain to our listeners or just tell us a little bit about the museum and the memorial itself for those who haven't had a chance, including myself, to visit it yet.
So I'm happy to do that. So, you know, the original World Trade Center was a 16-acre site, and for the redevelopment post 9/11, roughly 8 acres were put aside, the central 8 acres of the site, for a memorial, which opened on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, which is the two pools, about an acre square, filling the footprints of the north and south towers of the World Trade Center. Those two waterfalls with the names of all the victims incised around them. So that was the memorial that opened 10 years after the anniversary of the attack, the 10-year anniversary of the attack. And then in May 2014, the museum, which is almost entirely underground, it's 110,000 square feet, which people don't, you know, realize, because the entrance to the museum isn't as large as you would assume that size museum would have. But the bulk of that square footage is at what we know as the bedrock level. That's 7 stories below ground, under the pools, where the original construction of the World Trade Center began, and some of the elements of that original construction. So some of the original building elements are sort of central to the design of the museum, and they are preserved in the museum. So, you know, a visitor coming to the museum will have this vast space open up in front of them, looking down into it and then walking through it. You know, when you talk to someone about an underground museum, they think of these small, dark, cramped spaces, uh-huh. And nothing could be further from the truth in terms of what the experience of our museum is. And within the museum, we have two main permanent exhibitions. The first, and I think, you know, the most central one of all, is what we refer to as our memorial exhibition, which is a space devoted, you know, to the memory of those victims with portraits and profiles of the 2,977 victims of the 9/11 attacks and of the 6 victims of the 1993 truck bombing of the World Trade Center, the first attack on the World Trade Center. So 2,983 victims. And it's a very solemn but very moving exhibition area. And then we have a large historical exhibition, which tells the story of the event, the things that led to the event and the consequences. And so that's that's an extended a visit or a part of your visit to the museum. And then, of course, we have a special exhibition gallery where we've rotated exhibitions over the years. And in November 2019, we opened this special exhibition, revealed the hunt for bin Laden. It's open again to the public. We had to keep it closed for a bit longer for COVID reasons. The museum's been open again since last September. But, you know, now the exhibition itself, which you know, has media pieces, which has some wonderful object loans from some of the individuals involved, some of the intelligence agencies involved. And to me, the centerpiece loan is the very famous model that the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency built. It's 4 foot by 4 foot. It's the model of the Bin Laden compound before they knew it was the Bin Laden compound. Uh-huh. And that model was brought to the White House to brief the president. It was used by the SEALs to plan how they would conduct the raid. And then, of course, it became the model for a full-scale model of the compound, which was built so the SEALs could run through and drill on how they were actually on the ground going to carry out the mission. So when we got permission from NGA to borrow that, and you have to realize it's, I would venture to say, maybe the proudest object that they have in their entire institutional history, because it normally is located in a special setting just outside the director's office. So clearly anybody coming to see the director first gets to see that model. You know, when we were given the permission to borrow that, I felt like we had been given the permission from the crown, you know, to borrow the crown jewels. If you will. So, you know, it really, really cemented in my mind that, you know, this was going to take us in a wonderfully, you know, comprehensive direction in terms of how we could tell the story. And we use images of the model. We use other imagery that NGA released to us from overhead views of the compound and so on in the film itself.
Yep. Before we get into that, I just wanted to jump back a little bit and talk about there was, you know, different exhibitions in the museum and memorial. And like I said, I haven't been there, but I've looked at it online. And I think one of the most moving exhibitions is the photographs of all of the victims. And without having been there, I can already tell it's that has to be one of the probably the most poignant parts of anyone's visit, because I remember I visited the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem many years ago. And, you know, it, that's when it really strikes somebody, the scope of everything that's involved. You know, you talk about, you know, 2,900 and, you know, 73 people who were killed there, or 77 people who were killed there. But it doesn't really strike home until you see all the photographs. And I remember the same thing going through. They had as many photographs as they could, you know, bring up at the time at the Holocaust Museum. And that is a very moving part of everything.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. It's so we have in that memorial exhibition, there are basically two concentric squares. And the outer square, all the walls are covered with photos of that number of victims. And of course, you go into that exhibition and you would like to be able to look at all of them and pay them individual respect. But it's pretty clear you're not going to be able to do that. It's too overwhelming. And so that really reinforces what the nature of the crime was, which was a mass murder. And the other thing about it, I mean, I'm of a certain age, but it's striking to me just how young so many of those people were at the early stages of their lives, of their careers, of making families together with spouses. It's really overwhelming. And then the one last element is, you know, of the 2,977 people, they came from more than 90 countries. And, you know, there were people on planes or visitors from overseas, but many of them were immigrants to the country who, you know, were making their way. And of course, others were from long-established American families, doesn't really matter. But you look at the wall and you see just the extraordinary range of humanity. And I say that because, you know, this was an attack on the United States. This was something, of course, we felt probably most severely in New York because of the scale of what happened here. But the outflow of emotion and solidarity from around the world was really this really, really striking sense of, you know, what America was, what it represented, what these individual people who'd come here to make their lives, you know, the symbolism of them for people around the world. And I'll never forget, I was speaking to a Turkish friend who you know, has always lived in Turkey, you know, not an American, has visited here, loves it here. But, and she said to me, you know, I've lost my American dream. The idea that, you know, this special place and what it represents could be assaulted this way. It resonated for so many people, regardless of where they were.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, we say a lot, but it truly was. We talk about crimes against humanity. And like you said, over 90 countries were represented there. So that's it truly was. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
But we're talking with Clifford Channon here from the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. And now we're going to get into the special. I know you don't want to give too much away about the special. And I got to try to balance asking you about it without, you know, me kind of pushing for you to give too much away. But
No, I don't mind.
Yeah, I'm very intrigued to hear about, you know, how you guys came about working with the History Channel on this. And obviously, there had to have been a lot of bureaucracy and details that had to be worked out.
Yeah. No, it's you know, the project itself, which initially was just focused on the exhibition, it took more than 5 years to do. Mm. And, you know, I don't think I have to sort of make the case to anybody here that, you know, it made perfect sense for the 9/11 Museum to tell this story. It really is about the persistence of the United States in going after the man who was most responsible for 9/11. So, you know, but you know, that said, the real question then became to us, well, how do we do this? Because technically speaking, then and even now, the mission was classified in the sense that there was no real incentive for anybody within the bureaucratic command structure of the military or the intelligence community to sort of just start releasing things to the public. So everything that would ultimately wind up in the exhibition and the film was unknown to us when we started doing the work to put the exhibition together. So that raised a really interesting question. How do you curate an exhibition when you don't know what kind of materials could be available to show in the exhibition? Now, I'll back up a little bit because there's no question in my mind that we were able to succeed at this, first and foremost, because we are the 9/11 Museum. And I mean something very specific by that. Even before the museum opened, even before the memorial was ready, we would get requests from military, law enforcement, intelligence groups. We want to come and visit. We want to pay our respects. And so we would accommodate these requests as best we could, whether it was a construction site or whether, you know, up until this day, we do formal programs for all of these agencies. And it's a special visit for the agencies. Obviously, when they're mixing with the public, that's fine. But they, you know, it's an auditorium program for them. We're now at the museum. A visit to the museum is now a formal part of the training for all new FBI agents and analysts at Quantico. My point is, we had developed these relationships with the national security community over years. And my conclusion is, first off, they realized that their mission today, back then and still today, was completely tied up with the event of 9/11. And people were making many, many sacrifices these last 20 years because of 9/11. So my sense is, they looked at how we presented the 9/11 story. They respected the way we went about it. And I think it gave them a level of confidence to say, well, this is how they handled the 9/11 story, which is so important to us. Maybe we could consider how to cooperate with them on telling this other story, the story of the bin Laden hunt and the mission. And so we had some relationships with the intelligence community in particular. We began developing them, and we began to say, look, here's what our plan is. We don't know what there is. We don't know who could be available to tell us about what there is or tell us the story of how this was done. But, you know, we had many, many initial meetings where I remember this very, very well. It's a very funny memory in my mind. We would sit in a room. This happened many times. We'd sit in a room. We'd get the meeting, which is already something. we'd get the meeting and we'd be sitting, a couple of us, with, you know, some number of people from an intelligence agency. And we'd say, well, this is what we're doing. We're looking for the kind of thing that could make this point. For example, the kind of thing that would show just how extensive the intelligence sweep by special forces and special operators during their raids in Afghanistan, what that would look like. And inevitably, you could see the people from the agency kind of looking at each other and smiling, and sort of you could see the eyes communicating. And they wouldn't say anything in front of us because, you know, everything we were asking for was still classified, but at least we gave them a track. And sometime days or weeks or whatever it was later, they'd come back to us and say, well, you know, we sort of could give you something like this. And they describe it. And of course, we loved everything they described. They thought it was just kind of stuff on a shelf somewhere. But we were very, very happy to have it. And it was really through that process, which I must say, in a couple of cases in particular, there were people inside the agencies who made it their cause, or so it seems from the outside, their cause to take this idea and push it through the internal bureaucracy. I don't think we would have gotten through some of these bureaucracies if there hadn't been someone inside who was following it, who knew how the bureaucracy worked, and who could push in the right ways. Because all we could do was ask and say, gee, when do you think this is going to be done? Because we had nothing to say about whatever the considerations were that made it possible. And like so much else these folks do, I can't acknowledge them publicly. I've more than once acknowledged them directly, but that was part of the success, that there were people inside who trusted us and who believed the story needed to be told. And that got us objects that were loaned to the exhibition and some photos used in the film, but it also got us interviews with key people on the intelligence side who were involved for years in the hunt and who were there when that first breakthrough moment came, and they could describe that to us. And because those folks are still on active duty, it was, number one, just an extraordinary gesture by their home agency to allow them to speak to us. But, you know, the agreement was they could not be visible on screen for all the obvious reasons. And so some of them are just voices and some of them are shadowed figures in the film.
Yeah, you know, it's it was very interesting because I went through, you know, the digital version of this. Obviously, we haven't seen the film yet. It hasn't been released to anyone. Right. But going through the digital, you know, version of this, some of the intelligence people giving their, you know, appraisal of things. And it has to be really satisfying for some of those people who spent up to 10 years tracking bin Laden after, you know, we originally went into Afghanistan in like October of, you know, 2001. Mm-hmm. They finally kind of nailed him down in August of 2010, when they finally kind of tracked him down, and listening to those people. And then you have Leon Panetta, the former director of the CIA at that time.
Yep.
Talking about the big picture, and even had, you know, President Obama with his speech at the end.
Right.
Kind of ties it all in together, doesn't it?
It's incredible. And, you know, what we realized when we made the exhibition is we had done by then so many interviews and had so much great stuff that it just couldn't be shown in the exhibition. And so that really gave us the push to make a documentary film out of this. And one of the things we were able to do, and I finished the last interview for this film a week before the COVID shutdown. So we were just doing this all the way up to the end. We did get access on the military side to the key planners, the military planners of the mission. So the folks, one officer in particular, and then the people he brought in, who Admiral McRaven turned to when, you know, he told the president, we can do this, but I've got to come back to you and tell you how we're going to do this, because I have to speak to the people who will actually be doing it. I mean, those are the folks who for the first time are telling the story of how you go about doing this. How do you figure out what the risks are of flying 169 miles into a sovereign nation which is not expecting you and carrying out a military operation? This is a country that's supposed to be our ally, but you know, that's a complicated question. But you know, to get the first person voice of those folks, and then we added some of the voices of the pilots talking about, you know, their perspective on the mission. Because don't forget, the whole thing took about 4 hours, and about 40 minutes of that time was spent on the ground, which means 3 hours and 20 minutes, the SEALs are basically just passengers on, one of them describes it as, a ginormous bus. And so, you know, the success of the mission is in the hands of the pilots. And this is something that, because of the heroism and the extraordinary accomplishment of the SEALs, hasn't really gotten a lot of focus. So we were able to get the story of the helicopter piece of this mission, you know, how it was planned, what factors were taken into consideration, and working with the pilots, actually track the routes in and out of, by the helicopters before and after the mission.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that most Americans don't really have a great appreciation for is the amount of planning that goes into one of the, it's not just like, okay, yeah, a bunch of SEALs are going to jump on a helicopter, we're going to fly over, you know, 170 miles of Pakistani airspace, you know, take out a compound, then jump right back on and go, everyone go home happy. It's the detail that goes into that, and the amount of planning is just absolutely amazing. And I'm sure that you guys delved into that as well.
Absolutely. And of course, it's so detailed that we could only give a flavor right of it. But, you know, what was very clear, and we interviewed Admiral McRaven, and he talked about this, and then some of the planners did, every possible contingency that could happen, including, first and foremost, this was the first risk contingency that they planned for, one of the helicopters going down. So what happens in that case? What do you do then? Depends, of course, where it goes down. But the contingency, the two Chinook helicopters, which were the backup force, and, you know, the contingency airframes that would go in case of trouble, I mean, they were right on their marks when they were needed. So when that first Black Hawk goes down in the compound, there's, of course, a moment of shock for the pilots who were in the Chinooks waiting to see what happened. But essentially, you know, within 10 seconds, they're now in their phase of the mission, picking up, because they know what they have to do. And it was like that again and again and again, everything that, you know, they could imagine. And I would just add, these people were incredibly experienced. They had been warfighters in these kinds of operations for years. One of the things that was so interesting about it, and it applies to the relationship between the intelligence and the military side as well, you know, when they began planning for the bin Laden raid, they were working with people basically who they'd worked with before. They had trust, they had experience together, they had confidence, they knew they could rely on one another. And so, you know, all of those years of experience of running raids and missions in Afghanistan, in Iraq, sort of came to this finely honed machine that knew what it was doing, that had the trust across agencies. And so, you know, when the first military planner goes into the CIA to be briefed about what it is, and he wasn't told what he was there for, and he's given a folder that, you know, first page has bin Laden's picture on it. And he says, you know, he was in a small, basically they converted a closet for security reasons within the CIA, if you can imagine, because it wasn't shared. He looked around the room, he said, and these are people, a couple of them he knew because he'd worked with them as a military intelligence cooperation on missions before. And that really, to me, is one of the key elements in the success of this mission, and more broadly, the success of special operations. There is now, as you well know, as your audience knows very well, you know, the whole Joint Special Operations Command, the Special Operations Command, I mean, all of these things are relatively recent phenomena in terms of the history of the U.S. military. And it gives us a tool that is unique, it's finely honed, and when it is put to use, it has devastating effect. And that was certainly the case in relation to Operation Neptune Spear.
Absolutely. That was one of the things that, the creation of SOCOM was supposed to create, it was supposed to work that way. We learned during the Iran hostage rescue back in 1980, we need dedicated people to be able to work together and plan and conduct these type of operations. So we don't have that Desert One type thing, ever rear its ugly head again. And these type of operations, that the operators and the intelligence people have only gotten better as we've gone along. And now we have the capability to go anywhere just about in the world. And I'm really looking forward to this special. But, when it all, finished up, I'm sure you had a lot more material than an hour. You probably had to cut probably 10 times that out of all of the material you gathered up.
Yeah, that's a very painful subject for me. A couple of things. For reasons that aren't very interesting, but unfortunate, we also weren't able to do the book project we'd been planning around this. So I actually am hoping that we can still do something. So, there are some folks out there whose stories I would love to hear still, who know and are thinking about that. So there may even be, there's a lot more that can be said about this, of course. But, the challenge of doing this, we did 30, 35 interviews for the film, and that includes, the most well-known people. So you mentioned President Obama, Director Panetta, Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of Defense Gates, Admiral McRaven, so on and so forth. But, those are the people who were the big picture actors in this. And what we added to that, and I think it gives it, a great kind of granular feel, is we added the planners and the operators, whether it's on the intelligence side or the military side, the folks whose daily jobs was on the intelligence side to figure out where bin Laden was. And when they got, the lead to this compound, to try to make the case that this was different than all the other leads they'd gotten before. And then, of course, on the military side, very well, it really is in the details that these missions succeed or fail. So, getting a sense from the folks who had to do not just the detailed planning, but the details of the operation as it was happening. Because, when that first helicopter went down, of course, nobody knew immediately whether the thing had blown up, whether everybody had been killed or whatever, but they were out on the ground, all of them, all of the operators in that helicopter were out on the ground within a minute. And so the delay from this helicopter crashing was maybe 90 seconds or so. And of course, it left them in a position that they weren't originally planning to be in. That's why the model planning was so important, because they knew what was on the other side of the wall that they had to get through. And the second helicopter, instead of bringing their folks in and putting them down on the roof of the building, which was the original plan, they landed them outside the compound entirely. And so that didn't stop anybody. The improvisation, just the planning, the ability to react quickly. Frankly, it seems to me that's what allows for the selection of these folks to be in the positions they're in. They know how to think and act under conditions of great stress. But even taking into account the crash of the helicopter, by 10 minutes, this hunt for bin Laden is over. There's been a firefight in the southern building in the compound with one of the couriers. The other of the courier is killed on the first floor of the main building. The man who turns out to be bin Laden's son is killed on the second floor of the main building. And already then, so you realize there's been an exchange of fire. There are other armed people who have been killed before they could fire on them. But you're now in essentially a combat situation. And then you're still going up to the third floor in this dark building, which everybody had wondered whether or not it was booby-trapped to blow entirely. And there they go up, and that's where the mission is complete. But it's really, really, it's an amazing fact of this thing that through the 10 years of the hunt, the first time they knew for sure that bin Laden was in that building was when they saw him on the floor of his bedroom having been shot. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, you know, going through, like I said, the digital part of the museum, you know, that you had a quote from one of the Navy SEALs, and he mentions that, you know, as they were going through the compound, the women were trying to martyr themselves to save their husbands.
Yeah.
And that's when the SEALs kind of knew right away that something was very big in that compound. So it hadn't been confirmed, but it would be just seconds later. But that they kind of knew at that point. And I saw where you did interviews with a lot of the SEALs who were on the operation as well.
Yeah, that's right. We had they were all done anonymously. But we have six of the SEAL operators we interviewed. I think, unfortunately, five made it into the film. Six are in the exhibition. And so from different perspectives, being on different helicopters and just, you know, what that was like, because, you know, the guys on the second helicopter, they knew that there was a problem with the first one, but they didn't know what had happened. And so they're outside the compound. Their colleagues have gone down. For all they know, they're dead. And so they're on their own now, and they still got to carry out the mission. And so, again, that ability to just figure out how to do the job is remarkable. And I'm glad you brought up the point of, you know, their recognition of different indicators that this was a really serious place, including the role of the women in defending their husbands. You know, we have a couple of moments in the film where it's almost like the intelligence checklist that they were given before the mission is sort of running through their heads, and they're checking off boxes on their briefing as they're encountering things in the compound that absolutely, as you say, really gave them a sense that this is serious stuff. We're onto something big here, because what's happening to us right now is exactly what the intelligence folks thought would be happening if we were dealing with bin Laden.
Yeah, it's I mean, I've read some of the accounts of the raid there, and everyone who was involved in that, it speaks so highly of all of them because of the level of planning that we all know goes in those types of operations, and those helicopter pilots having flown with them in the past, not, you know, these particular ones, but as that's part of the 160th Special Operations Aviation guys. Those are the best pilots I've seen anywhere. They'll scare the heck out of you when you're flying with them because they fly right at the limit a lot of times, but there's no better people. And the fact that everyone was able to come out of that, you know, alive, and they were able to accomplish their mission, it's just absolutely amazing. I'm really looking forward to this special on Sunday night.
Thank you, Steve. I will say the 160th has just a remarkable history, but, you know, it really burnished that history even further with this mission. You know, one of the most remarkable things about the aviation piece of this, you know, the helicopter went down. The pilot controlled that landing to the point that he was able to set the rear wheel of the helicopter, which at that point was losing power, so it's not in total control, not in his total control. He's able to set the rear wheel on the top of the wall. So, you know, a foot either way, and that rear section breaks off, and you probably have an explosion. But he puts it down, so the wheel is resting on the wall, and we actually animate this in the film. Obviously, you don't have a video of it happening, but, you know, it's just a remarkable thing. And of course, the front of the helicopter sort of bumps down, but everybody gets off and carries out the mission. It's just incredible.
It is. And that's a supreme, you know, example of tremendous flying. And what people don't understand, you know, I remember talking with some people who don't understand a lot of, you know, the military side of things. And they were like, well, if the pilots are so great, why'd they crash it? And I was like, you don't understand, when you're flying into a compound, a helicopter usually pushes the air out. That's what gives it, you know, its lift capability. when you're flying into a walled compound, that air circulates back up underneath, and it takes away your lift, and it takes away a lot of the stability of these things. And it takes a tremendous amount of flying skill to do what that guy did and not get anybody hurt. That was the amazing thing, that that aircraft went down, but all of those guys were, like you just mentioned, they were able to get off safely to finish their mission. They did what they needed to do. Everyone walked away from it, and then they blew the helicopter up to, you know, so the stealth technology was safe. But
it's incredible. I mean, I will say, I mean, I've spoken to some of the guys who were on that helicopter, and they did have some issues, you know, afterwards, just having from banging so into the ground, but they went ahead and did that mission. I mean, it really shows that, you know, the true test of these folks, their training, their talents, their commitment, it's not when the plan is going as it's supposed to go. It's when the plan goes south and you still have to fulfill the mission. And, you know, if anything shows just what the quality of the folks involved was, it was just that moment. And of course, everything that was done, getting them in and out and the SEALs operating on the ground in that compound, it's just, you know, one moment after another of, you know, your heart and your throat. I mean, think about it this way, Steve. I mean, everybody knows the outcome of this story, but it's so tense to follow it to the completion, even though you know the outcome, because it's just, it's crazy that this actually happened and they managed to do it as well as they did. So I one of the things, you know, we, in making the film, we sort of thought a lot about, you know, how do you keep the tension in a story where you know the outcome? But the simple answer is, if you show just how much they had to take into account along the way, all of those risks and what actually happened, it just maintains the tension by itself.
Absolutely. And I know time is short. I know you have other commitments today, but before we let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add about the museum, the memorial, as well as the upcoming TV special?
Well, I'll do a couple little plugs here. And one is the History Channel, Sunday, May 2nd, 8 o'clock Pacific and Eastern time. We are open again at the museum, including the exhibition. So folks in New York are more than welcome to come. But if you're interested, we also have virtual tours of the museum itself, of the memorial, and of the special exhibition on the hunt for bin Laden. And people can go to our website, 911memorial.org, and they can find those tours and sign up for the virtual tours from wherever they're located. We would love to see folks at the museum when they're comfortable and able to travel safely. But, you know, in the event that that's not in the immediate future for you, I would urge folks to take a look at the website and come on one of our virtual tours.
Well, we want to thank you very much for your time this afternoon. And before we go, we just need to read a quick little note here. If you want to get SoftRep on your phone, download our free mobile app and get easy access to our articles, podcasts, and gear reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRep.com to get access to our library of eBooks and our exclusive team room forums and content available on all your Apple and Android devices. We want to thank our guests today, Clifford Trainin, from the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. And we encourage all of our listeners and readers out there, check out this special, The Hunt for Bin Laden. It's going to be on the History Channel on Sunday evening, 8 o'clock. I think it's going to be fantastic. Sir, thank you once again for joining us. We really appreciate the time this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Steve. I love doing it.
Okay. Well, we look forward to visiting in person as well the next time we're back up in the Northeast.
Please do.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.